Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Telecommunications Regulation and Infrastructure Division. We're going to begin today's hearing. We don't have a quorum yet, so we're not going to move to approve the minutes, but we do want to move forward with the agenda because we have a busy morning and we want to proceed in a timely fashion. Just a word about today's agenda. We have a two-part agenda, essentially. The first half hour is going to be two presentations, one from the Office of Enterprise Technology and the second from the St. Paul Neighborhood Network. So we'll move forward with those in just a minute. But just a word also on what's going to occur after that. Around 8:30 or so, the committee will consider House File 116, which is Representative Atkins' bill regarding customer sales or service call centers. And this hearing, of course, will be unique in that it will be a step in the direction of interactive committee. And the committee meeting is being televised on TPT 17 and also streamed online via the House website. So viewers are going to be able to email questions, live questions to the committee, to Representative Atkins, to us members, and answer an online poll on whether they support the bill. And the committee's website is www.house.mn/telecom, and that'll direct those who are following this to web features. Questions or comments can be emailed to telecom.committee@house.mn. Myself and my able colleagues here are going to email and post questions and comments. And generally, the purpose here, at least for me in a broad sense, is to begin looking at how we can use the Internet and these resources that are available to us to make the Capitol more accessible to those throughout Minnesota. And if you were like me this morning when you got up and looked out on this cold, dark winter day, you probably thought about maybe participating, us members anyway, via the Internet. But I appreciate you coming in and being willing to work with us on this interesting initiative. So, we do have a quorum at this point, and I believe Representative Hilty has studied the minutes and has made a motion to approve them. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor, please indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Minutes are approved. Well, let's move forward with the agenda today. I think first on the agenda is Gopal Khanna from the Office of Enterprise Technology. If you want to come up to the table and begin your presentation, that'd be great.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Thank you so very much for inviting me this morning. For the record, I'm Gopal Khanna, State CIO, Office of Enterprise Technology. I also have here with me two of my colleagues, people that I've had great pleasure to work with over the last 18 months and 17 days. To the left is Jack Reese from Office of Enterprise Technology, and to my right, Steve Halen from the ECMEC Consortium in East Central Minnesota. I was hoping that I'd have an hour, Mr. Chairman, but because I have a lot to talk about, nevertheless, I'm going to talk fast. It's a very exciting subject, the whole idea of telecommunications and what it does for our state and what it's going to do for us in the future. And since you have two presentations in 30 minutes, I'm going to try and move fast and leave enough time for questions as well. In the first term, Governor Tim Pawlenty put forth a very bold vision for shared services and created the framework for Drive to Excellence program for our state. As a matter of fact, he's been very loud and clear about his vision in terms of what technology can do for better and improved delivery of government services to our citizens. When I came on board 18 months and 17 days ago, and I looked at our assets and what we are doing, one of the things that really impressed me was this whole concept and notion and idea of MNET, which is Minnesota's Network of Enterprise Technology. And as you were talking about and moving our conversation and discussion towards shared services, I said, this is a perfect example of shared services. MNET is a mission-critical infrastructure that supports the delivery of government services today. It provides high value because it is an excellent way of aggregating resources, requirements, and engaging the public-private partnership to deliver solutions for the citizens. Here is a conceptual diagram of MNET. It is a network of networks. It is not just one thing, but it is a network that really aggregates and takes into consideration many networks that work together and provide services to the usage of these capabilities. Many of our agencies, actually all of them, depend largely upon the availability, reliability, and secure environment that this infrastructure provides to deliver the services today, and will be more so dependent upon that going forward in the future. I'll give you a couple of quick examples. Education today would not be possible without a shared network like the one that we have in our state, MNET. Today, our educators as well as student body from K-12 to higher learning all depend largely upon the availability of this network, so that the content is available, the information is available, knowledge is available through this network. I was in traveling with Commissioner Alice Segrin last year in the central region, and I was totally blown away as to how the teachers were using the capabilities of our infrastructure to provide learning opportunities for students in the northeastern, northwestern corners of Minnesota. Let me see if I can click this and make this happen for you. I have a few examples of... Well, technology is at work, Mr. Chairman. I'll move to the next one. Mr. Chairman has given me not too much time over here. So next. Healthcare applications, a lot of them depend largely upon the availability of our infrastructure and its availability and reliability. Public safety depends, and as a matter of fact, when it comes to public safety's service offering, it's really an issue of life and death, because you could be dealing with criminals, and the availability of information for our public sector officials who participate, whether it be the judges, lawyers, attorneys, corrections officers, patrol officers, sheriffs, etc. They all depend upon the availability of information that is made available through this shared complex. We have other mission-critical applications that are serving our citizens today, and a wide assortment of them, and again, at a later time, when we have more time, we can go through all of these applications that are being used today, that use heavily this infrastructure. OET's role in supporting and making this MNET environment possible can really be summarized in two, three things. We are the lead individual agency that makes sure that the strategies are established, that maintenance takes place, that updates happen, and that we harness the competencies and capabilities that are brought to the table by the private sector, and for the better good of the public sector needs and requirements. It's anchored around the education establishment, right from K-12, MSU, and University of Minnesota. When I first came on board, I realized there were some opportunities to further enhance these capabilities, and I focused in four areas. And we have accomplished quite a bit in these last 18 months. The first area of focus was looking at what the wide area network can do, how we can further expand and provide broadband connections to to additional communities that were not originally covered. And we have, over the last 18 months, reached out to additional 193 locations in 93 cities. Today, we serve over 1,000 locations and 300 cities. That's quite impressive. The other area of opportunity was leveraging new technologies to provide phone services using voice over IP capabilities. And we made that into a huge focus over the last 18 months. We have added 1,655 IPT phones, and we continue to do that and grow. We are now at a 7,000 threshold. We hope to achieve 18,000 in 2 years. It provides a more efficient, cost-effective program offering for our user base. The third area of focus was recognizing the power and capability of video conferencing. Knowing fully well that a lot of education establishment is currently using it, that can be used by other service provider agencies to communicate so that it prevents people from driving 100 miles, 200 miles for meetings. Mr. Chairman, that can be made possible today because of this video conferencing capability. And as they mature in the future, they'll become critical to our work and our service deployment. We added additional 85 locations over the last 18 months, making a total of 265 locations available today. And finally, the fourth area I recognized was extremely critical for us going forward would be to continue to strengthen and build our public-private partnership. This is one of the most amazing shared services complex, which is engages not only the executive branch, but all government entities, counties, boards, cities, K-12, and the private sector equally. From a public sector perspective, it's a perfect way to deploy efficient, cost-effective services and make them mission-critical applications possible. Literally, every major government entity is participating in this complex. They could not deliver the services without the availability, reliability, secure network that comes through MNET. And this pie chart gives you the breakdown of the usage. Of course, public safety is the largest one, second highest being higher education, health and human services, and all other entities. Private sector is an equally powerful participant in deployment of MNET. As you can see from this pie chart, 55 major companies that operate and work in Minnesota are part of making this telecommunication infrastructure possible. And they are an assortment of large companies to small companies. And in addition to these 55 providers, there are literally many, many more small vendors, business owners who serve at the local levels, providing hardware, software, training, staff augmentation capabilities that are needed throughout the state. MNET's reach is really very substantial. And as I said, over 1,000 locations today are reached through MNET capabilities. It is centered around 26 regional network hubs, leveraging the educational complex, and it terminates in over 300 of the state's 854 municipalities, reaching about 90% of the state's population, approximately 4.7 million out of the 5.1 million population base. There's a lot happening in this area, and we have much to be grateful to the private sector for participating. Today, 100% of the 731 wire centers, telecom hubs in Minnesota are connected to the world. Over 15,000 miles of fiber has been deployed by the telecom and cable companies, making this network possible. Even in spite of all of what we've accomplished in the last 13 years since MNET was first conceptualized and conceived, there's still a last mile issue, not only in Minnesota, but all over the country. Last mile issue is really an issue of where the citizen or the businesses can be reached from the point of deployment of the broadband access capability in the communities. It continues to be an issue, and it's an issue that really is a private sector issue to be dealt with. And I'll talk more about that, why it is what are some of the forces that will change that. Basically, there are three or four things that really contribute to the fact that it's an issue. One is the density of the population, availability of demand from the private sector perspective, because when there's a usage and demand, private sector is motivated to deploy and close that loop of the last mile. There are a couple of ways to close that loop. One is through wireless deployment, and the other one is by wireline deployment. And there's a tremendous amount of activity currently underway in our state at the local and municipal level, where local government is taking the leadership and saying and working with the private sector to close that loop and that little void in the marketplace. We already have Chaska, Buffalo, and Moorhead that have deployed broadband networks and have broadband networks in place using wireless capabilities. And you'll see that list of many cities that have huge activities currently underway. They're also using the wireline, where fiber broadband networks are in place in Windham, Morris, Detroit Lakes, Alexandria, and Crookston. And several counties are planning for their regional broadband networks connecting cities within their own jurisdictions. As I've said, there basically are four issues. We can analyze this from every angle, but basically as the incomes go up, there's a higher adoption rate of computers in the families, and as more and more students use computers, they create the demand for more content, more need for more availability of the technology and connectivity. Demographics too play a huge role in it, and the computer ownership. We as a state can help and have been helping in bridging this gap. And there may be two major things. One is by focusing on education. And education has two components to it. One is availability of computers. And the more the computers are being used by our student body, the more they ask for the content. The more they ask for the content, there's a greater demand for more access and capability. So it feeds into each other, and therefore creating the demand for broadband access and in the marketplace. And the other, of course, is as we deploy more and more of our services to electronic mechanisms and means, there will be more need for broadband as well going forward in the future. It creates the demand and the value for the citizens and the private sector. The national trends are more content, more availability, more reliability, more security, faster network. Speed is what is needed. And we also know that no single technology provides a silver bullet solution. We'll have to continue to use an assortment of solutions. What is our MNET's future in this? We have to continue to maintain it, take the leadership position to aggregate the requirements for our government entities, work with the private sector to make sure that we strategize with them and leverage the technologies that are available, and continue to expand the network so that the citizens that are not being touched today get touched and receive the services. The governor has pretty succinctly pointed out what our challenge is going forward. We need to prepare our infrastructure to serve the iPod generation of the future, and we are doing that. We are well positioned with MNET, and I believe that the extension that is needed is possible and can be achieved going forward in the future. More information is available on our website. I know, Mr. Chairman, that I've talked rather fast, but I'll be delighted to come back for questions. I do have my colleagues over here, and I'll take questions right now as well.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Connor, for that very enlightening presentation. I think we've got time for some questions if some members have some. Representative Hoppe?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Connor, thank you for the presentation. I have some questions. When you look at slide number 10, OET's role in MNET, the first bullet point is provides customer service and support 24/7 with a network operations center. Is that something that could be handled more efficiently or more economically by a private company?
Mr. Garner?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, can we provide it? I'm sure. But I believe we are providing that service today. We are providing economically, we are aggregating the state's requirements and working in collaboration with the private sector, where private sector competencies are being leveraged today to make this complex happen. So we are doing it in the most collaborative way that we can. So to answer your question, sir, we are providing 24/7 services. And we'll continue to do that in the future using the shared model that has worked extremely well for the state.
Representative Hoppe?
Follow-up, Mr. Chair. I'd like to hear more about that, not necessarily at this time, and like to find out the level of collaboration and how the state is working with private companies to staff or run or man or handle the NOC. Can I ask another question, Mr. Chair?
Please.
Where is the OC-24 that's deployed on the network?
Mr. Chair, Representative, may I ask the Jackies to answer that question for you?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hoppe, my name is Jack Reese. I'm a project manager for the Office of Enterprise Technology. The OC-24 connects the Centennial Office Building, which is a major hub, to the Quest Central Office in downtown St. Paul.
Thank you. One more, Mr. Chair.
One more, Representative Hoppe.
Well, I've got a lot more questions. I'm trying to temper this.
You're doing an excellent job.
Thank you. Glad to know I have a fan in the chair. I guess if I only get one more question, I'll ask it this way. When MNET is out and looking at all of the local little political subdivisions around the state that you're working with, is MNET ever competing directly with private business? I mean, do you ever run into, you know, McLeod or Quest or one of the other companies when you're looking to provide business to a library or a service to a library or a school district or something like that?
Mr. Chairman, may I ask Steve to?
Steve Holland, director of ECMEC, which is a telecommunications co-op in East Central Minnesota. We have the Office of Enterprise Technology as our network services internet provider. In order to leverage some federal money, we have to ask companies to give us the lowest cost provision, and we have a two-tiered approach where we have secured the lowest bid to transport our signals around East Central Minnesota with U.S. Cable, which is a cable franchise mm-hmm. in the area. In negotiating that contract, then we allowed for all governmental entities to also travel on those same fibers. So there was a RFP that was put forth, and companies did bid on that. And a company signed a contract with us and OET to provide that transport. We also have to do that when we look for internet access and services and private sectors in Central Minnesota have not been able to compete with us, and we're trying to save our taxpayers the most money we can. And so by the collaborations we have with the other governmental entities, it becomes a very good service for us.
One quick follow-up, Mr. Chair, and then I promise you can turn my microphone off.
Very good.
When you say that the private companies can't compete, can they not compete service-wise or price-wise?
They can compete, but with both service and price, but OET becomes the lowest cost provider and does provide us with service.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank
Very
you.
Good. Well, thank you for your testimony this morning. Oh, we have another question here from Representative Saylor, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Khanna, I just had a couple of questions referring to the last mile issue. First of all, I would like to know how local government is working with your office to close those real last mile gaps. And secondly, in your opinion, what do you think should be the state's role, probably your office, but the state's role in providing true last mile connection in the absence of private companies' participation? And we're talking the way last miles at the end, you know, it's because of economics. And theoretically, you know, the private companies are coming in, but it's a theory. And I'm just wondering what you see your role with that to be.
Mr. Connick?
Mr. Chairman, may I just ask Jack to address the which municipalities are working first, and then I'll come back to the second part of the question.
Mr. Chair, Representative. We do work very closely with the local municipalities, and basically what we look for, if they are putting in or have in place some infrastructure, whether they own it or they lease it from the local providers. We try to partner with them and be able to utilize some of that bandwidth that they may already have. So that's part of the collaboration and partnership that we work with the local municipalities. And we think that that's the right way to do business, because it makes total sense, rather than duplicate things that we want to share with them if they have their own, let's say, network, whatever it might be, whether they own it or they're leasing it from a provider.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, in as much as your question about what can be OET's role in bridging the gap of the last mile, I think so as a service provider, as our government moves from 9 to 5 to 24/7 model and deploys more and more services via electronic government, automatically it feeds into the demand creation. And the second component is, as we support and service the education establishment, K-12, MinSCU, and University of Minnesota, that too creates demand as well out in the communities, because the more the children use internet capabilities for their education curriculum, the more they bring technology back home, the more that happens, it creates the demand for the private sector to bridge that gap of the last mile. So I think so we, as a service provider agency, providing the shared services to government, not only the executive branch, but reaching out to all counties, boards, and cities, and working with them, we can play a very vital role. I think there are some policy consideration issues that have to be talked and discussed from a last mile perspective, and I'm sure the private sector has some views and opinions as well that need to be weighed in. But OET's role is going to be best as one that leads the position of being an anchor tenant and creating an opportunity for the private sector to participate and work together, as we pointed out, in providing cost-effective solutions and the deployment. And that's the role I envision right now, and again, it's one that requires policy conversation as well.
Representative Sarah?
Yeah, I have one follow-up. Thank you. I just am curious, have people from your office ever actually gone, like, way, way up north and, you know, been on the ground? That's a comment that I often hear from local governments, local businesses, that the state, actually don't ever show up at, you know, there and do a little ground truthing. I'm just wondering, do you send people from your office out to actually hang around for a day and find out how much fun it is? Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, yes, we do. We have Jimmy Johnson here, one of my associates from OET, sitting, and he and his team make sure that we are connected with the users at large throughout the state. I have myself traveled with Commissioner Segrin in various regions to understand what the needs and requirements are. And Mr. Chairman, Representative, we can never do enough of that, because as a service provider, we must be cognizant of that and do it more often. And I expect my team to do that regularly.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Holland, Mr. Reed, Mr. Connor, for your presentation this morning. I look forward to taking a look at your MNET board a little later on, so hopefully you can keep that around. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
We have one more testifier before we get to our first bill of the season. So if Mr. Wassner wants to come down and take the table. Mr. Wassner, if you just identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony. We have maybe 10 minutes.
Members of the committee, my name is Mike Wassenaar. I'm the executive director of the St. Paul Neighborhood Network, which is the nonprofit community access center that serves St. Paul. And I also serve as the chair of the Alliance for Community Media, which is a national organization which supports public, educational, and government television operations around the United States, and has done so for over 30 years. I've been asked to present a brief look, now I promise to keep this brief, at Minnesota's experience with PEG television, and give some perspective about the state's role in helping Minnesota's communities use television to support community education, to better inform our citizens, and to strengthen local culture. Public education and governmental channels have a strong history in Minnesota. Since the early 1980s, municipalities and community groups have used cable television franchising processes to help local media content come to their citizens through cable. In 2007, there are some 20 different PEG public educational and governmental operations in the Twin Cities serving 50 municipalities, and there are approximately 60 local channel providers across the state of Minnesota. When you compare that with our neighbors, Minnesota actually has a pretty impressive record. That compares to 40 operations in Wisconsin, some 30 operations in Iowa, and just a handful of operations in the Dakotas. Minnesota is seen as a leader, actually, amongst the United States in providing public educational and governmental television services to their citizens. PEG facilities in Minnesota range from large urban and suburban operations, which serve thousands of households, to smaller facilities and communities throughout the state. In some communities, the local government operates only one channel, carrying government meetings, school content, and publicly produced programs. In others, cities with greater communication needs, local communities have negotiated for more channels with local cable systems to carry more content. Here in St. Paul, we have 6 channels which carry PEG content and a 7th state-mandated PEG channel, Metro Channel 6. One of the unique characteristics of the franchising process in Minnesota has been its responsiveness to local needs and local circumstances. In our case, for PEG community television, this has meant the development of many different solutions for local communication needs rather than a one-size-fits-all approach. Community television operations, such as those in Little Falls, can be set up in a high school and coordinate their operations with the local high school curricula. In St. Peter, the operation is a local recreation center. In some communities, production centers have been located as anchor tenants in once-vacant shopping malls. It's a sort of unique approach to community development. The PEG facility actually acts as an impetus for community development. My favorite example, this is actually in our neighboring state of Wisconsin, where Walmart decided to leave the town of Wisconsin Rapids, and the city leaders actually had to decide what to do with a vacant building at the center of their commercial district. They decided to build a senior center mixed with a community production facility to help build the social connectedness within their community. That's actually the case in many cities across Minnesota as well. Another effect of the localized process in cable franchising is that the governance of the channels varies in each locality. Some PEG operations are run by a government or a municipal office. Some are located in a school district. Others are run by a nonprofit that contracts the service with the local government. And yet others are run by individual volunteers, so working at really the local level. As well, some municipalities have chosen to have their operations run by the local cable operator. In a similar fashion, the funding of the operations varies by locality. Funding typically comes from cable subscribers, either from the franchise fee that cities negotiate with cable companies, or from a separate PEG fee, which supports the operations content that goes back to the community. In St. Paul's example, viewers pay $1.50 per month to support PEG operations, separate from the franchise fee that the city negotiated with the cable provider. An independent poll of cable subscribers in St. Paul conducted by the Wilder Research Center 4 years ago showed that viewers of the cable system were comfortable with paying that amount for services that they received on the 6 channels that we operate jointly with the city of St. Paul, and they'd actually pay a higher amount if necessary for the commensurate amount of services that they receive. A common characteristic of all operations in the state is the mission serves part of the civic communications backbone in their cities. Government channels provide public safety and emergency communications to citizens. As well, they carry local meeting coverage and help citizens understand the workings of their government. They replay programs at more convenient times so that viewers can actually find out about what their government is doing. And increasingly, they're putting their meetings on the Internet in either a streamed or archived fashion so that there's more participation in local government. Just as importantly, public access channels provide citizens and political candidates the ability to express political views in an open, unbiased, and unfiltered format throughout the state. You'll probably all appreciate this if you've ever had to deal with the local media, but in many Minnesota communities, the only television media that covers local political debates is public educational and government television. The local presence is important in many communities, such as in Wilmer, where 4,500 cable subscribers are now presenting increasingly diverse demands in a diverse community. Wilmer is actually seeing requests for educational programming in Spanish, English, and Somali now. Wilmer's PEG Center operates 3 channels with a staff of 2.5 people. and airs approximately 11,000 hours of local content each year. You can compare that with a very different operation in Brooklyn Park. Northwest Community Television is perhaps the largest operation in the state of Minnesota. It serves 9 communities in the West Metro area and has 75,000 cable subscribers that it serves through the Comcast system. It produces a daily news program to local subscribers. And for those communities, it actually provides some of the best local news coverage that's available to Brooklyn Park and Plymouth, even though it's near the heart of the Twin Cities media market. Another unique aspect of community television in Minnesota is it's a heavy concentration of ethnic and non-English television production that takes place in both Minneapolis and St. Paul. This is because of the changing population within our communities, and also because of the lack of access to commercial broadcast outlets for many of our communities. For example, between our center and the Minneapolis Telecommunications Network, there are 9 regularly produced programs by, for, and about the Somali community in Minnesota, ranging from political discussions, popular entertainment, community health, language instruction, and vocational education for Somali Minnesotans. Some of the producers of these programs are professional producers who have been trained by the BBC, Italian, and German state television in their homeland in Somalia before they came to Minnesota, and now they actually want to better the refugee community that's now making its home in our state. Community television has played a similar cultivating role, an educational role with Minnesota's Hmong community in the 1990s. SPNN was proud to be the home of the first public television program in the United States in Hmong, Gigu Cha. Peg channels in the Twin Cities create an important outlet for these diverse communities who cannot find access in the commercial television market. One final aspect of community television I'd like to talk about is the economic benefit that local communities receive from their operation. For many artists, religious organizations, community groups, and nonprofits, the cost of media technology and training is prohibitive. Production centers make computer and media technology tools and training available to the public, much like a public library is useful in communication, community education needs. We actually can put a dollar value on that work. For example, in St. Paul in 2006, the public acquired in-kind media technology services and production equipment used at our studios that were worth the equivalent of $1 million. This actually has a real impact on the nonprofit and creative economy in our community, and it has a similar effect in cities of all sizes across Minnesota. A couple of brief observations for you before I end the testimony today about what the state can do in the future to assist these operations as you make deliberations this session. One recommendation I have is to act like a well-trained doctor and first do no harm. Minnesota law has encouraged an important civic sector to flourish over the course of the last 25 years. Many states have tinkered with their cable franchising laws in the last few years and have put forward one-size-all solutions that fit no community precisely well. And the jury is actually out still as to how well they accelerate infrastructure investment and spur price competition in the cable market. In one instance, state legislation in Texas has actually severely cut channel capacity and financial support for PEG operations, forcing some out of operation. Many proposed laws in other states say that PEG channels can exist, but financial mechanisms that allow them to flourish, particularly PEG fees that companies and communities negotiate to come from users of the programming, should be eliminated. This, in effect, actually places an extra burden on municipalities and creates an unfunded mandate by the states. The state has already done this, frankly, through its mandate of Metro Channel 6, which is a mandated channel in the Twin Cities that has no sustainable funding mechanism. We'd actually like to see you not create more situations like that across the state of Minnesota. Second, all of the PEG operations I talk with welcome cable competition and want their services to go to more people in their communities. They actually see this as being fundamental to their mission of connecting communities together. However, they don't want government to necessarily choose winners or losers in the marketplace, and they want their services to reach the entire community. This means that PEG programming should be carried and supported by cable competitors in an equitable fashion, as Minnesota law currently allows, and that governments have the equivalent build-out requirements for cable competitors. For many of us in the PEG community, it makes no sense for community service benefits that have a profound effect on our communities, like PEG, to only accrue to certain consumers in the marketplace who've been chosen by industry. If the community wants these services, they should have the ability to allow these services to flourish. Lastly, I would actually encourage you to consider ways to help grow our industry in Minnesota and to be a national leader, to grow capacity and expand services for all Minnesotans. A small example of this is furthering financial support or finding some way to create incentives for caption services for the deaf and hard of hearing in Minnesota. Currently, few, if any, local PEG programmers have staff time or technical capacity to provide this necessary service for what is a growing sector of Minnesotans. Unfortunately, we're all growing older. Many of us will find ourselves in this community, perhaps because of our listening to the WHO 20 years ago, but this is an important sector of Minnesota that actually needs to be served in the coming years. From talking with service providers working with deaf and hard of hearing communities, I can tell you that there's actually a definite need for more public safety information, community education, and public information available via video captioning for the community. With that, I'd like to conclude my remarks. I hope they've been brief. I hope I've got some time to answer any questions. I really want to thank you all for the opportunity to speak.
Thank you, Mr. Wassenaar. I think we have a couple of questions. Representative Beard?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Wassenaar, back to Cable Channel 6. I know it's on every cable network, and at least in the metro area here, but you're talking about no sustainable funding mechanism. This is news to me. And there seems to be no shortage of programming on Metro Cable 6. How do they make that work?
They make it work in a, Mr. Chairman, Representative Greer, they make it work in a pay-for-play situation mm-hmm. in order to sustain their operating costs and their technical costs. There is no technical support that comes from the local cable companies for Channel 6's operations. Almost entirely all of its operations are actually supported by fees that are given by producers to play on the channel. And this actually becomes, in effect, I don't want to editorialize too much, but this actually acts as a barrier to entry for producers who may not have the ability to pay that sustaining.
It would be analogous, Mr. Chairman, then, I believe, to what I used to work with in the publishing world, where sort of a vanity press. If I got the money, I can get my show on Channel 6, right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Beard, I make no editorial comments.
Understood.
It's roughly analogous.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Representative Beard. Representative Jenke?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are there any uniform rules or statutes or laws guiding public access channels around the state? In other words, or is it different on every municipality? If I, in our case, it's Charter and Entel, and we have Quest now starting to provide services out there. Public access is available. Am I allowed as a public person then to use the equipment and the facilities that we've allowed in our community as a franchisee coming in? And two, can I submit within reason, within public standards, programming to be put on my public access that I'm paying for? Is there any uniform rules that would dictate how that works around the state?
Mr. Chair, Representative Junkie, the use rules typically are determined within federal code and then also for the local municipality. So, for example, you could have, based upon the capacity of channels that are in your community, only one channel that provides programming for the municipality, local fire and police, the school district, and the public. So they may actually be rationing time to be able to get the amount of programming on that they need to. Those rules for time slot allocation are typically set up at the local level by either the municipality that's operating the channel or by the nonprofit that's running that channel. They typically have to conform to federal standards to ensure that the programming doesn't have prior restraint restrictions regarding speech. Typically, most communities require that the programming doesn't violate local, federal, or state law. In St. Paul's example, we actually require that programmers who give us programs are responsible for the copyright that they control on the programming and that they hold the City of St. Paul and our corporation harmless for any actions that could be against them and that they aren't breaking the law when they're putting their programming together. That's mostly set up by the local municipality. So within your community, there are municipal rules that have been set up with that access corporation, which should allow you, members of your community, religious organizations, political candidates, to be able to express themselves. But again, those use rules are set up at the local level.
So, Mr. Chair, Representative Beard wants to get his show on in his local municipality, and he doesn't have the money to pay for it, he should go to his city council and talk to them. Is that what you're saying?
No.
Mr. Wassner?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Junkie, without speaking specifically to Mr. Beard's financial circumstances, typically political candidates, for example, we'll have volunteer organizations that get training at our facilities to be able to produce programming that can go out to the public. That actually helps to strengthen the political process within those communities. So, for example, again, I can direct the representative to go to the Shakopee Access Center with his volunteers from his campaign committee to actually get technical training to be able to help him express himself. I know the representative doesn't need that much help, probably, but... It wouldn't be the case where the local candidate would go to the municipality and ask for more funding for them. They could actually ask for more funding for the technical operations that supports the entire community.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm not asking about more funding. I'm simply asking about access. I walk in with a tape, say I want to play my show that I produced myself. It's within public standards. And the franchisee says, well, you know, we really don't have the room or the time or the channel capacity, and and by rule out here, we don't have to put on everything. Do I then walk into my city council, who gives that license to run that cable operation, and then they would, in the relicensing period or whatever, that would be their negotiation with the public access people to get my tape onto the TV.
Mr. Washman, and again, members, we need to wind down this conversation shortly, but proceed.
Mr. Chair, Representative, it needn't be at that level of discussion. Typically, with those rules, that it's the level of discussion between the municipality and the access provider. I don't know if in that case it's the company or if it's a local corporation or a volunteer or the municipality itself, but those use rules are subject to often a lot of debate and negotiation at the municipal level. Okay. So it needn't have to go to that franchise renegotiation process, if I'm getting to the heart of your question.
I think we go to the city council. That's where I'm going to go.
Thank you, Representative. And thank you for your testimony this morning, Mr. Westman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Very good. We're going to move now to our first bill that's before our committee, House File 116, as Representative Atkins takes a seat at the table. And Representative Mason, you'd be willing to give us a motion here to get the Representative Atkins' bill before the committee?
Okay, I'd like to move House File 116.
Representative Mason moves that House File 116 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. Representative Atkins, we have the bill before us. Welcome to the committee. Tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. First, thank you very much for the opportunity to have this streamed online and on Channel 17, allow people to weigh in via the Internet. When I went to Chairman Johnson with the idea, I wasn't sure how it would be received, and he embraced the idea, and particularly thanks to Elizabeth Emerson, who put the whole package together. Hopefully it'll work. You can order pizza online. You sure ought to be able to weigh in on what your government is doing online as well. The call center bill is a bipartisan bill. It's got an overwhelmingly positive response. I don't think I've ever gotten so many emails or letters or phone calls saying what a good idea something is. Maybe it's just that I've never had a good idea before. But what it does is very simple. It's twofold. It applies to call centers. If you get a call from or place a call to an overseas call center, it just requires, number one, that if you ask them where they're at, they have to tell you. More important than that is if they seek or need private information, medical documents or medical information, financial credit information, and they have a U.S.-based location to send that to you or send that information to, they have to disclose that. That's literally all it does, folks. I got the question, this bill got a little bit of attention, and one of the issues that was raised was, is it really a problem? So I specifically waited and took 10 minutes before I came to the hearing this morning. Found three news articles that I'll give you just a brief overview of. One was an undercover operation found customer data for sale by outsourcers. Here's what it said. The kind of details they provided was alarming. Not just the names and addresses of customers, but also their telephone numbers, birth certificates, details, Medicare numbers, driver's license numbers, and ATM numbers on sale abroad. Number two, this was from September. A worker was found copying personal information about customers onto a compact disc. The U.S. clients are long-distance telecom service, a cable and internet service provider, and a food service company. The incident was after two other undercover operations by foreign media that revealed customer data was for sale online for a price. Third one, overseas call center employee, this is just in June, and a criminal gang stole $400,000 from bank customers. So is it happening? The question is absolutely yes. That's what I found in 10 minutes on the internet this morning. And the question, does it make a difference? This is the other question I got. Can it be done here in the United States as well? Obviously, the answer to that is yes. Why is it so important that we try to have that data kept here? For security purposes, number one, and number two is if somebody does commit fraud or steal your assets, we can prosecute them here. We can prosecute them under our laws. So for those reasons, I'd appreciate your support. There are a couple of people that would like to testify this morning. We've got some folks from the Communication Workers of America. And actually, in deference to the committee's time, if y'all, who's ever going to testify, can kind of line up like in the batter's box here.
All right. Sir, if you'd identify yourself for the record, who you represent, and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name's Jim Levison. I'm the president of the Communication Workers of America Minnesota State Council. And we support the consumer's right to know customer service and call center bill, H.R. 116. As Representative Atkins says, it's a very straightforward bill, and this is something that we have worked on now. This would be the second session that we've worked to get this bill passed. We came very, very close last time and lost it on a technicality. The passage of this bill into law will give Minnesota consumers the following rights. When calling or being called by a sales service center, Minnesota consumers will have the right to ask where the service center is located. And the call center representative will have to disclose that location, state, or country of the center. Minnesota consumers not feeling comfortable giving foreign call center employees their personal or financial information will have the right for an alternative phone number or website in the United States if one is available. So we think we've worked with the people that felt that this was harmful to business as usual. We felt it was something that was needed, and we've gone forward with it. We just appreciate your support on this legislation. We think it's a good bill for the consumers here in Minnesota and protect them against, as was stated, identity fraud. Because if you have identity fraud or your identity's stolen in a foreign country, it's almost impossible to get that resolved. In the United States, it's very hard to get it resolved. But we also know that we think this is a good bill also for business, because we know if it's credit card fraud, that if you report it right away, your credit card is probably credited, that's taken off. And the people that pay for that are the credit card companies, the banks, the financial institutions. And so I think they should be very much aware of what's going on and also supporting this. We'd like to see these centers come back to the United States.
All right. Well, thank you very much for your testimony. And the way we're going to proceed here is we're going to hear from testifiers in favor of the bill and then hear from those who might have some concerns. So that's the plan here. The next testifier, if you just identify yourself for the record and who you represent.
I'm the lead. My name is Lee Grotchik. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Senior Federation. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the Atkins. Members. The generation of seniors that the Minnesota Senior Federation represents are as varied as the general population. Therefore, I won't make any sweeping generalizations. However, many of our members do have a concern that there be clear, concise, and safe parameters regarding the solicitation of private information and data, such as medical and financial information. The idea that this information is literally traveling the world begs a number of questions. Who has jurisdiction when problems arise? Who has access to this information? And just how vulnerable is this information to abuse and misuse? As Representative Atkins pointed out earlier, one only has to read the newspaper to get a taste of the potential vulnerability of such information. Though giving the consumers a UFC option doesn't guarantee the information won't be misused, the hope is that it will cut down on potential misuse. As more miles you drive a car increases the likelihood of an accident, the greater distance this information travels increases the likelihood of identity theft and fraud. Though it's hard to determine, it seems that this sharing of information solely within our borders affords seniors and consumers a bit more protection. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Graxit. And our next testifier, to identify yourself for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Brian Bergson. I work for the Attorney General's Office here in Minnesota. In general terms, the Attorney General's Office supports legislation that protects consumers. This legislation does that, and so without having directly spoken to the Attorney General yet this morning about this, in broad terms, the office supports consumer protection. And also this bill, it seems, would allow action to be taken against those companies that are selling this data. So quite simply, that's the testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Bergerson. I think Representative Thiessen has a question.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair.
For the witness.
Who would be prosecuted under this?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Thiessen, I guess it depends on the home of record of the company. And it gets a little bit tricky depending on where the company is physically located and where the call center is then located.
But Mr. Chair, just to follow up.
Representative Thiessen?
So the company who is, you know, for instance, whatever the company would be, if they're a U.S. company and their call center is in India, and the person in India, the fraud here, first of all, would be not the stealing of information, but they're actually not saying you're from India, but you're actually from Minnesota. Is that right? Or from, you're not saying you're from India? Is that what the fraud is?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Thiessen, I guess I'm going to have to defer to the author on that.
Representative Atkins.
Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen, this question has come up. I appreciate the opportunity to address it. The bottom line is that right now we have a multitude of laws that apply to businesses that do business in Minnesota. This, in fact, we've visited, and I'm going to invite them up here shortly, the industry representatives to visit. We've tried to work with them as well. They understand that if they do business in Minnesota, they've got to comply with Minnesota law, and I'm sure that they intend to if this becomes Minnesota law. Secondly, in terms of the fraud that we're most concerned about isn't necessarily just telling what country they're calling from. It's if they want to use or collect credit information, financial information, medical information, and they have a place to send it here in the United States. That doesn't guarantee safety for it, but it makes it much more or much less likely that it will be the subject of stories like this, where it's that sort of information is available for a price abroad.
And just one more question. And the reason I raised this question now is for the Attorney General's office because of the Subdivision 3. So I understand that there's this issue with the fraud and the newspaper articles, although it wasn't clear to me from the newspaper articles where that information was stolen from, whether it was telecommunications marketers and stuff. But my question was going more to the violation. Maybe this is an issue for civil law or whatever that committee is called now, as to who would actually be prosecuted for the what fraud are we prosecuting here? And if the chair would prefer to wait for a different committee that would have jurisdiction over that, that's fine with me.
Yes, I think that'd be satisfactory.
Okay.
Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr.
To this
Chair.
Point, sir?
For a question for Mr. Bergson.
Sure.
Mr. Bergson, when you said that this will protect Minnesota consumers, how specifically will this protect consumers in Minnesota?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Hoppe, I guess it allows a course of action for those consumers that have been a victim of fraud. You know, if you want, again, more specifics,
Again, Mr.
Representative Hoffman,
this might follow on Representative Thiessen's question and be more appropriate for another committee. I'll ask, if I could, one more follow-up question, and it might have to be answered again in whatever civil law is today. If this is to protect Minnesota consumers, isn't there federal law already in place that would protect Minnesota and all United States citizen consumers from this kind of thing? Isn't this unnecessary and duplicative?
Mr. Chair, Representative Atkins.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Representative Hoppe, the best type of protection is prevention. All this requires is disclosure. And if the consumer is aware of where their information is about to be sent, and if the Foreign Call Center has an opportunity to send it someplace here in the United States, that hopefully will prevent these sorts of examples from occurring. And so that's the primary point. We also, Mr. Chair, reference to the questions about how this would be processed, we expect to take that up in the full committee when it goes to the Commerce and Labor Committee as well.
Good. And Representative Hoppe, one more follow-up,
Mr. Chair. Thank you for your patience with me this morning.
Very good.
Representative Atkins, you just said if there's a, and I'm paraphrasing, but if there's Minnesota consumers can check to see where their information is going, and if there's, they don't want their problem issue handled by a foreign call center, what if there isn't a U.S. call center?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Atkins.
Representative Hoppe, if there is not, if that opportunity is not available, then it would still go abroad.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Atkins. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Certainly. Representative Beard, did you have a question?
Yeah, and it's to this line of questioning. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Probably for Mr. Bergeson or the author. I'm trying to think of the triggering mechanism, how a complaint is filed and what threshold you're going to need to instigate prosecution here. Is it going to be someone's word against someone else? Can we actually record our conversations and take the tape down to the prosecuting, to the county attorney? Do we need it in writing? Because I'm trying to get at the heart of just what triggers this and what the real problem is here. You follow me? Because I've had instances even in the campaign where somebody will make an allegation. You're a politician. You've had it too. And you go, what? That never happened. Well, then it's his word against her word and so on and so forth. What is going to be the procedure for procuring evidence and prosecuting fraud, getting restraining order, or is it just going to be the benefit of the doubt to the Minnesota citizen?
Representative Atkins?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Beard. Now I know where the civil justice or the public safety division is, or committee. It's and we will right here in telecom. It's an excellent question, though. And the bottom line is most of Minnesota laws come down to exactly that. It's you look for the most credible testimony, and sometimes it really is what one person says versus what somebody else says. The bottom line, I expect we've got really good folks that do this sorts of business that have call centers. It's not, you know, we contact Dell or we call these folks and ask them for advice on how my computer works, which is here in front of me. I expect them to follow the law, and I expect 99% of the time that's exactly what is going to happen. And I think if we called all these wonderful folks that are here in the audience to listen to this discussion today, they'd tell you exactly that. And I think that's the most important thing, the ounce of prevention. They'll follow the law. Consumers will have an opportunity to keep their private data here in the United States, and that's going to work 99% of the time. That other 1% of the time, you're right, Representative Beard. Consumer may be saying one thing. The call center might be saying another.
Representative Beard, follow-up.
Yeah, just a follow-up comment, and then I'll let you have these poor folks proceed. But, you know, this is the telecom committee, and just a half an hour ago we had the state CIO was talking here, and in fact the map's still up there about how interconnected the state is. And folks, colleagues on this committee, I guess I would just caution us to remember that this world is wired just like that, because this stuff moves at the speed of light. Information that's stolen from a dumpster in Cloquet is not going to be pawned on the streets of St. Paul. It's going to be pawned on the internet in some offshore location. So it's not necessarily, and I understand the nobility and the good intentions behind the bill, but this world is connected at the speed of light now. So it's a good thing this bill is starting here, and it's, I think, appropriate for us to talk about these issues, because we have a great telecom industry in this state, and we're wired and connected with Belarus and India and places we probably couldn't even pronounce here this morning. So I just want to be careful that we recognize that we're a state, one of 50 states, dealing in a global community when every nation has its own sovereignty. We had this discussion on the floor yesterday about 8 states and 2 provinces, for crying out loud. It took us 3 hours to argue our way through that. So just know that this goes way beyond feel-good legislation and gets into issues of sovereignty and just what power Minnesota has when we're dealing with India, Pakistan, or whatever other country we want to point at this morning.
Senator Atkins, comment?
One brief response to that, Mr. Chair, Representative Beard, is that if that happens in Cloquet, or if it happens in California, we can bust them. We can send folks from Mr. Bergson's office,
exactly,
and we can prosecute them. If it happens in Cairo, mm-hmm, it's not exactly the same thing. Not as easy for the Attorney General to go after them if they're in Cairo as opposed to in Cloquet. Mr. Chair, I do know that there are a couple members I've tried to work with the folks from the industry and adopt some of their language, but I know that they'd like to be heard as well.
Maybe we could, before we move on to further questions from members, if that'd be satisfactory, we'll hear from those testifiers and then proceed with further questions and hopefully a few emails. Identify yourself for the record, please, and who you represent, and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Tom Hesse. I'm with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I'm going to have my little prop here, just so you can remind yourself of Representative Beard's line of questioning here. The world is flat, and sometimes things that we do here in St. Paul might not have much impact in the global scheme of things and where businesses are located. Mr. Chair, members, again, my name is Tom Hesse. I'm with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. And the Minnesota Chamber represents about 2,400 businesses throughout the state in a variety of, in all sectors of the economy. 80% of our membership has 100 or fewer employees, and we are also affiliated with about 130 local chambers of commerce around the state. We do appreciate the work that we have been able to do with the author over the last 2 years on this bill. We've certainly addressed a lot of our concerns through that work and effort, and we hope that we can address the remaining concerns we have with this bill in the future. But we do, as I said, we do have a couple of concerns that remain, and they basically have in two or three areas. One, operational issues, and second, customer relations or customer service implications. So I'll touch on those briefly. On the operational problems that we see with the bill, as stated before, the bill does allow a Minnesota citizen whose call is taken by a foreign call center to request an alternative if one exists before any information is given. However, how is the call center supposed to know this is a Minnesota citizen if they cannot verify information by having the caller provide some sort of identification? I think the only way really to get that done is to have the citizen input their phone number, which will obviously take some time and lengthen the length of the call. So the citizens will, Minnesota will wait longer. It'll take longer for them to address the questions that they see, that they want addressed if this legislation passes. In addition, I think sometimes it's not technically possible to transfer calls from foreign centers, foreign numbers back to the United States. At least that's what we're told by some of the telecom folks that we speak to. And if the transfer is possible, sometimes they are dropped. And again, all of this gets to the fact that we think one of the end results of this could be that there's poor customer service to Minnesota residents because of some of the operational issues that this bill contains. Again, this will inconvenience customers in a couple of other ways. Calls are oftentimes routed to the call center that has the shortest waiting time. If this legislation were to pass, that might not necessarily be the case. It will lengthen time if the call has to be transferred back to a U.S. center. It's also... as previously mentioned, calls can be dropped or more time spent trying to identify the person that is a Minnesota resident and can access or can have their call addressed in a different fashion. I think this will generally lead to more frustration on consumers' parts, and that frustration sometimes looks, it ends up being a poor reflection on the company that operates. So we're concerned with that. One of the reason stated for this bill is the security of customer information, personal information. And we don't think that necessarily is an issue, since under federal law, as I think already spoken to, consumers have the same privacy protections for the company itself and their affiliates and their contractors. So a call center in the United States and a call that's not operated by the company, it's a vendor or a contractor, has to operate under the same privacy protections as the company itself and any foreign company that is a contractor to a Minnesota company or other U.S. company. So those privacy protections are in place. That means they will, if people are victims of identity theft or fraud, they will be compensated, they will be made whole. Again, the privacy issue, I think, is already dealt with by federal law. And maybe raise one more issue, and then I'd be happy to answer some questions. We do believe that restrictions on that require the redirection of calls from overseas call centers to domestic ones discriminate against trading partners and break past U.S. commitments covering federal and state activities with respect to communication services. When a similar bill was debated in New Jersey, I've been told by some national counterparts that the European Union was interested in the legislation because of its potential discriminatory impact on EU member companies. And that, I think, is one of the reasons why no other state has adopted similar legislation, that they were concerned about these potential trade implications. We plan to work with the author between now and the Commerce Committee to try to address some of the operational issues I discussed, and we're happy to do so. But with that, I'll be happy to answer any questions.
I think Mr. Hesse, any questions for this testifier before we move on to the next person? Representative Pilty?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hesse, I thought that was a very interesting description of this bill. It doesn't seem to square with what I'm reading here at all. My reading of the bill doesn't require the customer to do anything, and the only thing it asks of the caller is to tell the truth. That's the only thing it asks. If somebody calls me right now, no law withstanding, I have the capability of saying, where are you calling from? And in fact, I always do that. And my experience has been that they almost always tell me. If they respond, if a caller told me that he couldn't tell me where he was calling from, I think my next option would be to hang up, and that's what I would do. If they did tell me and I didn't think that I wanted to give someone my personal information that was located wherever they were, that's still my option to say, well, sorry, but I think I'm just going to pass on this opportunity. So this bill doesn't change any of that. The only thing the bill does is say, if you ask that question, we would like the responder to tell the truth. And if the responder doesn't tell the truth, then that constitutes fraud. I don't see why we would have a problem with that. What is your problem with that? You think people ought to be allowed not to tell the truth, or what are we talking about here?
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Hesse?
You're talking about calls that you receive, and consumers already have the ability to sign up for do not call lists and limit the amount of calls that they receive from call center activity or from anyone trying to market. You can certainly do that, and I think many customers have. But think of calls that you place. If you have a problem with some product and you're trying to get some answers from a company, you are initiating the call to a call center. That's where the operational issues take place. They're trying to identify, the call center will have to identify where you're located. You don't always call from your place of residence. you might have a second home outside the state, but you are a Minnesota resident. So that there's operational issues on identifying where the caller, is the caller a Minnesota resident when you're initiating the call. Second, that's where the longer wait times come in, because they're things will have to happen. If you're initiating the call, things will have to take place in order to comply with this that will either add cost, add length of time, and we think result in poor customer service.
Representative Hilty, follow up?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Hesse, that's still my option. If I don't ask, if I place the call and don't care to ask any of those questions, it can proceed just fine. And the only thing, it doesn't matter who placed the call, whether I received the call or placed the call. You know, it's still my option to ask the question or not. And presumably if I ask the question, I will get some kind of response. And the only thing we're saying here is it should be an honest response. It's my option after I get that response to do whatever I want to. I can proceed, or I can say, I'm sorry, I don't want to talk to you anymore. It's just a question of whether we get an honest response. And it's entirely my choice whether I want to prolong the conversation or not by asking those questions. If I don't wish to, I don't have to. This doesn't say you have to ask. It just says if you do, they have to tell you the truth.
Representative Atkins, to that point?
Just a point, Mr. Chair, that is, I certainly don't intend to cause the demise of the European Union as a result of this bill, and I hold Mr. Hesse's comments and most of the Minnesota Chamber in high regard, and I expect to continue to work with them. We've come, I think, very practically. We've found some good language that has brought us this far. I'd anticipate we'll continue to work with them. I also highly regard what Representative Hilty has said, which is basically all I'm doing here is asking that the call center operator tell the truth, where you at, and if there's a U.S.-based location, to send private data. With that, Mr. Chair, we do have Mr. Anderson here from the Minnesota Retailers Association. I know that he wants to be heard on it as well.
Do you have a question, Representative Moore, for this witness?
Well, I do, Mr. Chair. It follows up on Representative Hoppe and Representative Hilty.
Proceed.
My question is maybe perhaps, though, best for Representative Atkins. Under Subdivision B, what I'm reading here is that we have the right to request to contact, but as I tell my kids, not every request is granted. Do you intend that actually that if a person requests to talk to a call center in the U.S., they are going to be transferred? In other words, could we remove the words at line 2.4, request an alternative option, and simply have it say the right to contact a customer call or service center in the U.S.?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morrow, I think that is a very good suggestion. And maybe as this bill travels to the next, hopefully as it travels, assuming you all fight it, I'll consider that. I think that's a good suggestion.
One quick follow-up following from the
Representative Morrow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Testifier mentioned telephone calls on line 2.1. It says received a telephone solicitation, yet in 325E311, we define telephone solicitation narrowly under Minnesota statute. Following the testifier's comments, it might be that we need to change telephone solicitation to telephone call.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mora, that's a good suggestion as well.
We have another witness that we can...
Mr. Chair, to Mr. Hesse, I'd like to ask him on that point.
Oh, okay, very good. Representative Thiessen?
Just that the suggestion of Representative Morrow, was that part of the compromise you guys had reached out, worked out? I'm kind of guessing it might be to remove that language or request an alternative option as opposed to forcing the direction, or maybe not.
Mr. Chair and Representative, certainly some of the language that we worked on over the last couple of years did involve the alternative option. I'd have to go back and look and reconstruct some of the changes that were made. To know if every word was in that discussion.
And just to follow up, what that would mean, what that language change would mean, would that you'd actually have to set up another call center in the United States as well as overseas, or you just hang up on them?
Representative Atkins?
Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen, no. That's not the case. The original language said exactly what you just said, which is there'd have to be a U.S.-based call center. Part of the compromise was that they had to disclose if there was one. If there isn't, then you know, you'd be stuck with having to make a decision as a consumer whether you wanted to provide that data to an overseas call center and take the risk that it might become subject to one of these eventualities, or just keep it to yourself and find another way to get the job done. But no,
and just one more follow-up. And I guess going, building on Representative Hilty's comment that a person can do this anyway, this is kind of what I was trying to get at with the Attorney General's office, as what the fraud is. I mean, you can do all this if that's what all this bill is about, is say, if you're overseas, I'm going to either make the choice to hang up or not. And so is the violation to prosecute the person overseas? I mean, I think this kind of does go to the heart of the bill a little bit. And if I'm not sure if it's going to go to public safety. It doesn't sound like it might go there, so maybe we should just address that issue here.
Mr. Atkins, that question?
Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen, the bottom line is that it's still, if it's, we apply to Minnesota businesses or businesses that are doing business in Minnesota. That's where our hook is. It's obviously going to be difficult to prosecute somebody that's wherever they are, outside of the boundaries of Minnesota. But if we've got a Minnesota business or somebody doing business in Minnesota, that's where the Attorney General or a county attorney or whomever can prosecute them. Currently, we don't have this in Minnesota law. If they don't want to tell you, they can just say, no, I'm not going to tell you. You're right. As a consumer, you could say, well, all right, then I'm going to hang up. But I have a great deal of regard for the folks that are doing business in Minnesota and the call centers that they've hired. That if they're given this instruction, they will follow the law. And I think if we called, we've got a whole bunch of them sitting around the room here. If we called them up one by one, I bet you they'd tell you the same thing, that they intend to follow the law.
Okay, Jensen, do you have a...
Yeah, just to the point Mr. Hess was talking about, well, you know, there's not already always an option to transfer a call and this type of thing. And I would suggest you leave in the request, unlike my good friend Representative Morrow, request an alternative option. That could be simply giving a phone number of some place to call in the United States. That is an alternative option. I think that should remain in there, and that it's not, that won't take any more time or effort or phone lines. You can request, I want to contact someone in the U.S. Okay, here's a number of our sales office in Texas. You know, so it's not just that you can't transfer a call like Mr. Hess said. I think it's broader than that.
Representative Beard?
Yes, Mr. Chair, maybe to the author of the bill. With this new language that may or may not be a compromise, it seems that if there is no call center in the United States, the consumer is still left with a decision to make. I'm tongue-in-cheek guessing that the thrust of this is to remove any possible decision the customer would have to make. So do you see that as a weakness in the bill, that there are still options for the consumer, like hanging up or deciding not to pass their personal information to someone who may or may not be in the United States and may or may not be telling the truth?
Representative,
is that a weakness in the bill?
Mr. Chair, that's a weakness in civilization, Representative Pierce.
Thank you, Mr. Rogers.
People may not tell the truth.
Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to Representative Junkie's point, I think if we do that, what you suggested, then we're going back, and I'm agreeing with Representative Morrow, I think then we're getting into the position of telling companies to do business in Minnesota, you have to have a call center somewhere in the United States. What do we do if they don't? What do we do if it's a company based in, I don't know, a big computer company that sells computers all over the world that's based in Texas? Or what do we do if it's a company that's based in Germany and does business here and doesn't have a call center in the United States? I mean, are we going to compel these companies, if they want to do business in Minnesota, to have to open a call center here?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Atkins, do you understand?
The bill doesn't require that, Mr. Chair. Representative Hoppe, it specifically does not require a call center. And my friend from Minnesota Chamber is nodding accordingly. That's exactly what this bill does not do. It does require them to disclose it, however.
And Mr. Chair?
Mr. President,
to that point, on 2.5, it says if the alternative option is available. So if it's not available, they do not have to provide it.
Mr. Chair and Representative Tucky, I understand that, and that's, I thought what you were saying is that they would have to provide it.
No.
Okay.
No.
Members, we do have one more testifier here that would like to take a seat, so let's give him the opportunity to provide his testimony. If you identify yourself for the record, please, who you represent?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Buzz Anderson. I'm president of the Minnesota Retailers Association. Our members have more than 2,000 store locations throughout Minnesota. I want to thank the chair and the members of the committee, and I especially want to thank Representative Atkins for having worked with us over the last couple of years to work out some of the problems we've had with the bill. We've certainly made some progress, and we really appreciate his accommodation. Minnesota's been on the cutting edge of international trade since Governor Perpich in the 1970s and 1980s tried to make us aware of the fact that our marketplace is no longer our state or even our country. It's actually the world. And every governor since then, to some degree, has carried on with that tradition. Our own governor, in his last term, led a delegation to Canada, to Poland and the Czech Republic, to China, and he's leading a delegation to India in 2007. So the point is, the genie's out of the bottle. And this bill really ignores the reality that what companies in today's marketplace have to do to stay competitive is they need to be international. One of my members that has call centers handles more than 45 million calls a year. They have call centers in Minnesota. They also have call centers in other places in the United States. And they also have call centers in locations around the world because they are an international company. The decision on where to locate a call center depends on a lot of factors like cost, the type of expertise that's accessible, availability of technology, time zone differences, access to growing markets. Well, some just use phone call centers for no other reason than to supplement a call center in Minnesota during peak hours. Let me tell you another potential problem. There's also the possibility of unintended consequences when restrictions like this are passed. Making additional demands on existing call centers may force companies to move call centers located here to other locations. Sadly, the unintended consequence could be fewer jobs in Minnesota. I'm also told by the International Technology Assistance Association, commonly referred to as the ITAA, that the American IT industry is the strongest in the world, already running a multi-billion dollar trade surplus. More specifically, a trade surplus in the U.S. by exporting our IT products and services that are created abroad by imports of those products and services. It's very much unlike the textile and automobile industry, which run large trade deficits. The IT industry runs a very healthy trade surplus. Another unintended consequence is that legislation like this can also send an anti-business message to both U.S. companies and international companies that might be considering locating or expanding operations in the state. This is particularly true for any business that competes worldwide and needs to make the most efficient use of resources. We should be encouraging expansion and relocation in Minnesota, not discouraging it. Now, one of the things that I've come to appreciate that's a great advantage of living in a free market system is that consumers get to vote every time they make a purchase decision. Companies know that. When a company puts together a business strategy to attract customers or to maintain customers, they need to take a lot of things into consideration, including how will the new customer or the longtime customer respond. The call center becomes an extension of the company brand, and if the customers are displeased with how a company runs their call center, it'll affect the brand, and the customer's buying decisions will be affected. My point is that the marketplace regulates this activity very efficiently, and it does it with no central direction. There's also little evidence to demonstrate that call centers taken outside the United States are less safe from calls taken inside the United States. Further, if you look at some federal regulation, it requires businesses to provide comprehensive privacy protection to personal customer information that they use or share anywhere in the world. It's not just the customer that's watching this activity. It's already protecting this place in federal law. Now, the issue of rerouting is something I know very little about, but I know that it's very complicated from a technology standpoint, as I talk to my friends and colleagues in the telecommunications industry. I'm told that this bill asked in terms of rerouting may not be technically feasible. Now, whether it is feasible or isn't feasible, it will raise costs. And if you add a couple of minutes, or even just a few minutes, to millions of calls, it's going to raise costs, and that cost is going to have to be borne by consumers. Now, again, according to the International Technology Assistance Association, this legislation has been introduced in a number of states, and it's been rejected for many of the reasons that I've just passed on to you. I have one more point, and that is that I have been told that one of the consequences of passing legislation like this is we may be running contrary to federal law and the ability of the federal government to regulate international trade. Now, again, I'm not a lawyer. It's just something that's been flagged for me. So, with the greatest respect and deference to the author and to my friends in the CWA, I would ask you to seriously reconsider whether or not this is good legislation, whether it should be passed into law. I'd be glad to stand for any questions.
Mr. Jenkin?
Just quickly, again, and thank you, Mr. Anderson, for your testimony, and I have the utmost regard for your group and your businesses, but nowhere in here is there a requirement to reroute calls. That's not in there. So that was the same thing that Mr. Hess said. There's no requirement for rerouting calls. It just simply says to request an option to contact someone else. That could be giving you an email address, a phone number, or some other way to contact a center in the United States. It's not to directly reroute your call to this country from another country. I don't believe that's in the bill, and I just think we need to get that clear as people are debating this as it moves on.
Mr. Anderson, comment?
Mr. Chair, members of the judge, I appreciate that, and that is certainly one of the things that we've been working on to try to accommodate business concerns in this bill. Some people do not have call centers located in this state, and so it would not be possible. I think the point I was trying to make is that if we were to go back to the language, as was suggested, that we require that a call be sent back to the United States, it may not, in fact, be technically possible. I don't understand all the subtleties of this business. I know that you have a mix of technologies. I know that you have interchange facilities in different countries, and again, it becomes very complicated and I think probably very expensive.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. Representative Mason, did you have a question?
I have two questions. One is, given the diversity that we have in this country, normally if you're talking with somebody at a call center, you have no idea whether they are in this country or not. So, I mean, if you hear somebody with an accent, typically you're going to ask where they're from, just as a matter of curiosity. But the bottom line is, you should be, in my opinion, you should be able to ask where they're at and get a correct answer. And then the other thing is, if you're calling, specifically if you're calling somebody, you are directed to another country, I find it really difficult to believe that they can't redirect the call or get somebody in this country or wherever. The speed at which you can make communications available today is just incredible, and that just doesn't make sense, at least what you're saying at the end.
Representative Hoppe, you have a question?
I have a question for the author, Mr. Chair, if that's okay.
Please proceed.
Representative Atkins, going back to the cases you cited when you first started your testimony, the cases from last year, would any of those been prevented by this law?
Representative Atkins?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hoppe, all of them. They were all foreign-based. I specifically, and like I say, it was only a 10-minute survey. I wanted to see how many I could find in a short period of time. And, in fact, all three of them would have been preventable because it wouldn't have been transferred overseas.
Follow-up, quick one, Mr. Chair. So they would have been preventable had the person opted to go to a different call center, if there was one available.
Mm-hmm. Representative Atkins?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hoppe, the primary focus of this is that if it's kept in this country, we have the ability to prosecute here. Our laws apply here. They don't necessarily apply to folks doing business in Canada or Mexico. I would add one other comment with respect to Representative Mason's comment, is that with respect to some of the call centers and knowing where they're at based on accents, for the most part, I think their English is better than mine. My Minnesotan is in some of the comments here online that I'd be happy to share with you as well indicate that maybe there should be some additional, maybe some, it's running 2-1 in favor, by the way, but one of the comments was that the bill doesn't go far enough in a couple of ways. And one was that one person commented that maybe we should require customers to provide further information as well. But
we're going to hear a few more, couple more questions. We're going to look at some of the comments we've received over the internet. But did you have one more follow-up?
Real? One last question to the author, Mr. Chair. Representative Atkins, is this constitutional? Does this violate the Interstate Commerce Clause or take the state's privileges of government a little farther?
Representative Atkins?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hoppe, these laws are, we regulate businesses that do business in Minnesota all the time. It's absolutely constitutional. I will certainly give, as I noted earlier, I don't want to cause the demise of the European Union.
I would vote for it if we did, by the way.
But, well, it may not be within our purview, Representative Hoppe. I will certainly take his comments into account. But we do this all the time, and those other laws have been found constitutional.
And Representative Pilty.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Anderson, I have to stick by my original analysis of this bill, which is that, you know, I think maybe some of the wording in here is a little unfortunate. It says the customer has a right to request. Well, you know, we don't have to have a right. I mean, of course we have a right to request. We can ask anything we want to. And Representative Atkins maybe might want to think about changing that particular phraseology, but Mr. Anderson, this just comes to the same thing. All we're asking here is if the question is asked in this kind of situation that the respondent tell the truth. Do you see anything in this beyond that? I mean, it's just saying if they ask a question, tell them the truth. If there's a call center, tell them where it is. If they're in Uzbekistan, tell them that's where they are. I mean, what's wrong with that?
Brief comment, Mr. Anderson?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hilty, I can't imagine any reputable company asking their call centers, wherever they're at, to deny a customer's request to tell them where they're located.
Isn't that the point? We're talking about companies that might not be reputable.
We're going to move on to Representative Thiessen. After Representative Thiessen, we're going to look at, because I know people want to see what some of the email comments are. We're going to move on to take a look at a few of those after Representative Thiessen.
I'll pass.
Representative Thiessen passes. So let's take a look if we can get him on the big board up there, what some questions or comments might be, and give opportunity for members or testifiers or the representative to respond.
Mr. Chair, you took my computer away. I was busy voting in favor of the bill online.
Well done, Representative Atkins.
Now over 100 in favor, Mr. Chair. And I did notice, as he's pulling those comments up, Mr. Chair, that it seemed to be running about 2-1 in favor. It's not an overwhelming number of people that have voted on the bill, but one of the comments was that it doesn't go far enough. That kind of mirrored what Representative Morrow had indicated, that the language should be stronger. There was another comment, though, that said maybe it went too far. And then there were a number of folks that just weighed in and said how important it is to provide protect their data privacy. So hopefully I've accurately represented what I just said, because they're about to pop up here.
Representative Hoppe, this would be a good time to ask a question.
Mr. Chair, I'm glad you're finally seeing things my way.
I'll pass, Mr. Chair.
Well, we've seen it. Let's vote.
All right. I'll read it off here. It says, I don't think the legislation is necessary. Foreign call centers are here to stay. The privacy and identity theft issues are very real. This is a federal and international issue. I think these are comments we've heard during the discussion today. Is there another comment there, Mr. Page?
And Mr. Chair, I would agree with the second part. It's both federal and international, but that doesn't mean that we shouldn't do the best that we can to prevent it here.
Mm-hmm.
That's another one, same comment.
My eyes aren't quite big enough. Okay. This one says, I support House Bill 116. The bill provides a vehicle for enforcing minimal protections of private information. The consumer has the choice under the bill to either invoke this minimal protection or not. It does not prevent companies from using overseas calling centers, but provides a minimal standard for those centers, only where private data is involved. To vote against the bill is to conclude that providing minimal protection for consumers is less important than private information. Did author or anyone else want to respond to that?
I'd love to, Mr. Chair.
Certainly.
It'd be very interesting to see where the emails are coming from.
Well said, Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair,
mind no going.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hoppe, I only typed with two fingers, so that one wasn't my comment. Far too long to be my comment.
And we'll take a couple more here. My wife and I support Atkinsville 100%. Please vote for him. No. Please add our names to the long list of supporters.
Thanks, Mom.
Mom and
Dad.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, that was an interesting Freudian slip.
They were the ones looking for a 1-800 number. They don't have the internet, Mr. Chair. Just delete the bad ones. Okay? No, I'm just...
This one states, I've been in the service center call business for over 12 years. Are you going to add a reverse law? What about call centers that have a hard time with hard-to-understand accents that live here?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, that would be...
Representative Atkins, any comment?
My Minnesota nasal twang, whenever I talk to anybody else across the country, they accuse me of having the accent. I haven't considered that, but I'll take a look at the language and see where that leads.
All right, I think we're going to move on to voting at this point. If there's... there might be one more comment here. I'll read this one as well. The bill is a good starting point in line 1.22. These words should be removed upon request. The identification should be required, and it says in line 2.5, the words should be removed before the information is given if the alternative option is available. U.S. alternative should be required. So those are just a few of the comments received today over the internet to provide further discussion points. So, is there any further discussion of this bill at this point? Now, keep in mind that the next stop would be, if we pass the bill, is the Committee on Commerce and Labor. So, if not, those in favor of the motion to pass the bill and refer to the Committee on Commerce and Labor, please indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The motion does prevail. House 116 is recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. Thank you, members, for your time.
Sure.
The meeting is
Thank
adjourned.
You very much.